Hey guys, welcome to the Field Crafts Rattle podcast. I'm your host for this advertising space, and I want to thank our sponsors that make this podcast totally possible. The first sponsor is Sig Sauer. Guys, Sig is an awesome company. I'm a Sig nerd when it comes to their products. I'm a Sig junkie when it comes to training at the Sig Sauer Academy. There's always a Sig project that I want to kind of mess around with. And my current Sig project, in case you're interested, is building up a Sig 220 pistol that I should be able to acquire pretty soon from some department trade-ins a couple towns over from my hometown. Put on a threaded barrel for that guy and then attach my SRD 45 suppressor, which is made by Sig, to that pistol. And that will be my dedicated 45 ACP suppressor pistol. So I don't know. Like I said, I'm a nerd. I built up a lot of different things over the years, plugging and playing with the 320 and the 365 and the Sig Tread pistol and the MPX, which, by the way, the MPX is probably the most fun firearm you will ever shoot, just because the trigger is super, super fine, very little recoil. And, you know, people joke and they say that the MPX is the MP5 killer, and I'm not surprised. Guys, Sig Sauer is one of those companies. Like I said, they have products, they have training. Please check out the Sig Sauer Academy. There are a lot of good folks that train up there. I've had incredible opportunities to train with Sig. Bullets on Vehicles is one of my favorite classes. The 3-day Introduction to Long Range or Precision Scope Rifle, that's a great class. The Defensive Shotgun class is awesome. You know, a lot of people poo-poo the shotgun, and the instructors up at Sig, they know how to run a gun. And when you are, you know, using the combination of a shotgun and a pistol, and, you know, you're getting a chance to work around barriers. And I mean, it's just a fun class playing with the pig. So please check out Sig Sauer. Please check out Sig Sauer Academy. They are solid, solid people, great company, and we're proud to be affiliated with them. There is another company we want to recognize, and that is Vertex. Guys, there is a discount code that I want to alert you to, and that's 20% off using the code, get this, ready? Really original? Fieldcraft. That's FIELDCRAFT. Fieldcraft will get you 20% off of the Vertex website. And Vertex is a company that we've partnered up with over the past couple of years. They've attended a couple of our trade shows. I know a bunch of the guys here have Vertex bags. You know, I've worn Vertex pants for a while. You know, I'm more familiar with their apparel than their bags, but I'll tell you that their pants, when I did a TV pilot show for the History Channel in 2016, I wore a pair of their pants through the desert and 25 miles through all sorts of nasty stuff. Their pants was, I put all this like pine resin inside my pant pockets. I still have those pants to this day with that resin in there. Those pants are going on 6 years now, and they're badass. They're great, great for training. So the interesting thing with Vertex, in addition to getting 20% off of your order, you can pay attention to their site, because maybe, and I'm saying maybe, but I really mean definitely, we'll be launching an updated version of our Recce shirt. We had a Generation 1 Recce shirt. It was really, really popular. It's my favorite travel shirt to this day, right? There are buttons on it snap buttons instead of just like regular buttons. And it's just a really comfortable shirt. Well, I've seen the prototype of the one that Vertex is doing, and it's great. So pay attention. It's coming up. That's going to be the new Recce shirt from Vertex. Again, 20% off of their site with the code FIELDCRAFT. And their site is www.vertex. That's VERTX.com. All right, guys, here we go. Let's get to this podcast.
All right. Hey, guys, welcome to the Field Crafts Rattle podcast. I'm Nate Jones, and I'm here with Robbie Kroger.
Correct. Well done.
From Blood Origins.
Just like the supermarket.
Only because I've lived in a place that a Kroger supermarket exists.
So let me tell you a funny story right off the bat.
Okay.
So I come to this country 2003 to do a PhD. Uh-huh. I got a PhD in wetland ecology and aquatic biogeochemistry. And I'm earning as a PhD student $9,000 a year. That's it. So I'm like, okay, how am I going to make ends meet? So one, I become a bouncer in a bar.
I can see that.
Because then I get free food and I get a free bar tab. So I was like, all right, as a South African, that's really priorities. Because that's where the majority of your budget's going. But secondly, I'm like, all right, I got to fly to South Africa. At the time, actually, I had to fly to Australia for family Christmas. And I obviously have no money for gifts. So I go to Kroger.
Ah, okay.
And I buy all the Kroger name brand stuff. Like there was bricks of coffee that was like Kroger coffee and chocolates and whatnots. And I wrap them in Kroger supermarket packets.
Like the packets or like the thin shopping bags?
The shopping bags.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I'll tell you what, everyone thought that this was the best thing under the sun because nobody had ever heard of a Kroger supermarket.
Right.
They loved the gifts.
It must be all the high end, you know, like
yeah,
the so delicacies.
The first time my parents came here for, I think it was my PhD graduation, like my mom and dad insisted to have photographs outside of the Kroger supermarket with the Kroger sign behind them and whatnot. So
awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Because it tasted so good or because they were just like, they're like, this was your plan.
This is
like,
our family name. And this is the family name sitting on the, and you know, to this day, if I go through a Kroger and they like, you know, they see my credit card or whatnot or my ID, they're like, oh, do you own? And I was like, nope.
That's,
I wish if I did, I would not be right here.
That, I mean, that's if, yeah. If you ran out of ideas, that's definitely the next one is, do you own this? Like, yeah, just put it on my
tab. Put it on the tab. Yeah. Doesn't the family have a tab? Yeah, come on.
That's the way I would have played it.
Yeah, 100%.
Blood Origins.
Yeah. Right?
We're hearing it out here today. We're going over some med kits that we came together to help make sure we have you guys outfitted with.
Yep.
Going to all kinds of crazy remote places in the world. But before we get into that, actually, I'm not going to tell my funny story.
Let me hear your funny story.
It's only funny to me.
Okay.
But,
should I laugh? Just
probably.
Okay.
That'd be really polite.
All right.
I was telling my wife of the story when we first like Zoom called.
Okay.
And, you know, jump on the Zoom call and, in like just introducing ourselves. And I said, hey, you know, and I said, hey, how's it? And again, the Hawaiian pigeon thing that I just picked up when I was living there, I love it. And I take it everywhere I go. But when you came back and you were like, what did he say?
Exactly.
And I kind of had this like, what? And I'm like, well, am I being too informal? And then I said, how's it? And you're like, oh, and like, we're going to get on, you know, get on like a house on fire. Yeah. And I was like, does he not like me?
Oh, you thought House on Fire was a bad thing?
I've never heard that before.
You've never heard that before?
Yeah, I was really...
No, House on Fire means like fire and houses get along really, really well.
I was like, I told it to Dee Dee's husband, who's the firefighter. He's like, yeah, that sounds like we're fucked. like that's, and I was
brilliant.
I was really relieved. I was like, oh, okay, no.
This
is a good thing.
Either, I don't know. We use it in South Africa, so it must be a British colloquialism.
Got it.
It's like, yeah, you're going to get along like a house on fire.
I had to Google it.
So, but what did the Google say? That it was good?
Yeah, basically like becoming friends extremely fast. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, well, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, how's it is just a brilliant... There's a couple of sayings in South African that are just brilliant terms. How's it is one of them because it means so many different things. Like, how's it?
Yeah.
Are you doing well? Or is it just like, hey.
Right.
Hi.
Yeah.
How's it? Right. Just now is another one. I don't know if you ever heard of just now. So somebody will say like,
steal it though.
Hey, do you want some coffee? And I'll say, yeah, just now.
Okay.
For someone like American, they're like, what does that mean?
Right.
Do you want it now?
Right.
Or do you want it in 5 minutes? Do you want it in an hour?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just want it just now. Like probably 5 minutes, 10 minutes kind of thing. Just now. And so, yeah, how's it just now? There's a couple of others that just people are like, what does that mean?
If you think of one more, I definitely want one more because I like
it. It'll come to me during this podcast and I'll just blurt it out.
Okay, that'll work.
I'll use it in my...
And then I had to tell the story. I was like, okay, so then we had that interaction where I was like, I don't know if this guy, likes me because that was kind of informal. And then we're having a conversation and then you went back behind the couch to snag something. And I like leaned into Rob and I was like, dude, he's got, the skin on the couch.
Yeah.
And I forgot you had your earbuds in. And then when you corrected me on the animal, I was like, oh gosh, I was like, I'm doomed.
Yeah. We'll have to work on your animal taxonomy.
That was embarrassing.
For sure.
But, I'm glad that, so far. It hasn't been what I thought it was. What I was worried it was going to be. I'm like, oh gosh, this is going to get awkward.
No, man, I appreciate it. I appreciate being on the podcast too.
Yeah, yeah. So to give everybody a little bit of background, Blood Origins, how you guys, you know, your start, how Blood Origins got started, and a little bit about what you guys do.
Yeah, so I'm from South Africa originally, came to the States in 2003, came to do a PhD. When you grow up in South Africa, you want to be everything that American kids want to be. Policeman, fireman, lawyer, whatever. But you also want to be a game ranger. So you want to be that guy who...
I can see that.
The Jeep jockey. You want to be the guy who drives the American tourists around and shows them that tree, shows them that bird, shows them the elephant, shows them the zebra, lift up your binos. Can you tell if it's a male or a female zebra? Uh-huh. And they're like, oh, we can't tell the difference. I say, well, look, if you look really carefully, a male zebra is black with white stripes and a female is white with black stripes. Oh, yeah, I can see the difference. I was like, no, I'm just shitting you. I'm just bullshitting you. Okay. So that's what you want to be. You want to grow up and then you sort of migrate. You get, you then be able to take walks and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I've always been in wildlife conservation. Obviously, my career path was a wildlife conservation path, but I never hunted in South Africa, period. I grew up in a town of 8.5 million people. Didn't talk about hunting, never interacted with hunting. That was not my circle of friends. But my family was steeped in hunting heritage. My grandfather was born in Russia in 1912 in a place called Khabarovsk. He said he lived the two hunting paradises that this world had to offer. And think about it, like today's the hunting paradises, if I had to say the hunting paradises of this world, Tanzania probably still is a hunting paradise. Australia, there's some places in Australia that's pretty amazing. New Zealand's pretty amazing too. But he lived in the 1920s, 30s, and then the first bit of the 40s. He was in northern China, Russian Siberia, Tibet, hunting that. He hunted white-eared pheasants in Tibet. Like, I don't know anyone else
that can tell that story.
Could say that they did that.
That's wild.
Then he moved his entire family to Mozambique, which is Portuguese East Africa at the time, 1954, and then lived the heyday of Africa, which is the Theodore Roosevelt. Okay, Roosevelt was obviously in the turn of the century.
Right.
But the landscape was the same in the 50s and 60s and 70s. There was just very little people, very little pressure on the resource, and prolific game. And so these guys would go, they'd load up a Unimog for 3 weeks and just go into the bush. And a part of the kit of the unit, we talked about kit all the time. We'll talk a little bit more on the podcast about it. But one of the kits was a 55-gallon oak cask of white wine that would go with them. And so all I have are these stories of those days.
Yeah.
He was a prolific writer, so I got all the writing. But I just never got to participate. And we pigeon hunted once and dove hunted once in a field, but that was it.
Are the laws in South Africa, I say laws, maybe it's more culture is what I'm trying to capture of like out here, like hunting is like it's relatively accessible.
Not accessible at all in South Africa.
Got it.
So everything's private. There's not a single stitch of public land that you can physically hunt on in South Africa. Not even a square inch. There's public land, but there's no hunting on it. Okay, you can go hike, but also there's also not the public land system in America. And I think this is the thing that sort of the way that Blood Origins evolved and how we get to where we are today is that this that you have, that now I'm sort of privileged to be a part of, being an American citizen, thanks to people like you, that my boys are now raised up in. You don't get this anywhere else in the world. Like, we could leave here in 20 minutes, go walk on a piece of public ground, and we didn't have to tell anybody. We didn't have to pay anything.
Right.
We could even have a loaded weapon to chase a resource that was open if we had a legal tag to do it.
Yeah.
In South Africa, if there was a public land that you wanted to go access, you'd have to be a park. You'd have to pay a visitor's fee. You'd have to pay an access fee. You know, and you can go hiking.
Right.
There's very few areas. There may be some in South Africa. So somebody listening to this is probably like, there's this place. It probably is. But so this is why, like, this thing that we have here, this privilege that we have here, the opportunity to hunt here is so different. And where I came from in South Africa to where we are today here in America, Like, that's why sort of the underpinning, the foundational piece of why I started Blood Origins was this, like, man, you don't realize what you have.
I, you know, it's funny that you talk about it being like a privilege, and which is absolutely like absolutely true. And it's it feels obviously more of like a right.
In, it's not a right. Know,
in my mind, like when in Arizona, for example, like when I grew up as a kid, like you just went out to go use the public lands. And then now they started charging these like day passes, essentially, mm-hmm. to have to go do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And at the same, like that generated a whole conversation among us of like, man, can you imagine telling somebody 100 years ago that they needed a fishing license?
Yeah.
You know, and how, what of a wild reaction they might've gotten from that.
Yeah, and that's what I went to Cody, Wyoming last year, and friends of mine took me out of town and we drove along this road and they used Onyx maps and they parked at this intersection and they got out and we just started walking. I said, sure, we can do this. I'm like, yeah, you're on public ground here. This is your ground. It's your land. We can do what we want on this. Right. And we walked up to the top of the cliff and watched the sunrise and
yeah,
it was brilliant. It was absolutely mesmerizing.
Right.
So that's what Blood Origins. So when I take all of that background, all of my history, all of my family, and all of the written word that my grandfather did, and then I've got the trophies on the wall, essentially some of his African trophies that you've seen. And I was like, wow, man, why can't we? And I was getting more and more into hunting. I was getting more resources so I could go to Arizona to hunt from Mississippi. I could go to New Zealand. I could. And then I've got two small boys at the time, 5 and 3. And I was like, well, like, what am I going to tell them? Like, if we go hunting, I can tell them biologically, like, why we're going to do this. Why are we trapping or why am I killing? But I couldn't really tell them why from, like, here.
Right.
Because the industry, like, that I started learning about didn't really get into the whole, like, vulnerability, emotional components of this tradition, heritage called hunting. So I was like, man, we need to showcase like our heart more. So how do we do that? And so at the time, my wife and I were teaching Sunday school, and I was transfixed by this. They've slowed down a little bit, but at the time when we were doing this, they were just blowing up. Was this Christian testimonial project called I Am Second, and it's filmed absolutely incredibly. It looks like 50 cameras around them. They've got like the it's just this white chair, set of lights above them. Everything else is black. And they look directly into the camera. There's no like side quarter interview. And it's funny, the way that we interview at Blood Origins is like camera direct, like look down the barrel of the camera and that's how you engage. And so for 5 years, that's how I've trained myself.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in Georgia filming a Blood Origins episode and the Fieldcraft team was there, and they asked me to interview them. They asked me, can I be interviewed? And I said, sure, no problems. And they set the camera like this to me. And the guy that was interviewing me, Julian, was sitting right here. And it was the hardest interview I've ever done. And I'm used to being in front of the camera. Like, I've got it. I've got it down pat. But I couldn't look at him with the camera right there. I kept doing this. And he kept saying, stop looking at the camera.
Creeping.
I was like, oh, like I can't, I don't know, you know, it was so difficult. But that piece, that I'm second piece, it almost makes you feel uncomfortable. And that person's like burying their soul into you. I was like, man, I want that feel. I want that feel for someone talking about what hunting means to them. And so that's where we started. We started just talking about stories and narratives about people. And then I thought that we were going to be like this typical hunting show. And at the time, I thought we were. I didn't really know what we were going to be, but that's what I thought we needed. So then I got into the whole model of, okay, how do we fund this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do I get Eberly Stock to pay for what we do?
Right.
So I would approach an Eberly Stock, well, Fieldcraft Survival, and I'd say, hey, got this idea. You want to sponsor us?
Right.
And I got 100 people saying it's a great idea, but no.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone kept saying no, 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 no. And at the time I was like, why? That's such a good idea. But I didn't know that there were 1,000 other people like me looking for a quote unquote hunting show. But what it did for us was it said, we don't belong to anyone. We can talk to whoever we want. We can wear whatever we want. We can talk about whatever we want. We have no affiliation to anyone, which set our integrity completely apart, that we didn't sell out to anyone. Not that I would have, because nobody gave me money.
Right.
So
I still remember that from our first conversation from the get go, you know, as we're building things coming together, it's, you know, like we're not beholden to anybody. Like we belong to everybody.
But the thing is, like, that's why we're here. Like, once we turned ourselves into a nonprofit, which we are, we're a 501c3 public charity. And so now we have a model by which we can fundraise. And because we had set ourselves in such a way that everyone could see themselves in us, it was super easy to go get 3 optics companies to say, yeah, we'll support you.
Right.
2 camo companies, you know, various bullet manufacturers. We don't belong to anyone. We belong to everyone. But one of the things, and the reason why we're here, is what I've started realizing is that when we go places like we did last year in Zim and Zambia, there's going to be certain intersections of what we do that we actually do need to belong to someone. And we need to be able to have a resource base that we can tap into, which is probably more important from our perspective or my perspective. So we got into a jam. We got really bad heat stroke in Zambia. And I was like, man, I had nothing. Like, I didn't even have electrolyte packets. I think we were already out of electrolyte packets. I didn't even think through these kinds of things. So I was like, man, I need someone to be able to, like, trust that we can build a medical kit specific to our needs. You know, we could buy a generic one. Like, and MyMedic has given us some equipment. They actually just donated a bunch of anti-poaching stuff to send to Africa. But it was bulky and I had no idea how to use it.
Right.
And we took it and I was like, man, this thing's too big. So I need to custom it. I need to customize it. I need, and then I need to know, like, how to use it. And that's why we're here. And that's why we engage Fieldcraft Survival, to say, can you help us? Can you be that point for us? And sure, there's going to be some marketing opportunities from it. Okay. But that's not the point that, from my perspective of why I'm doing it. Why I'm doing it is that I need help. And I need to have a point of connection. Of like, okay, hey, I've got this. We're going, you know, Botswana, New Zealand this year are the big trips. But say next year, all of a sudden something else comes up. Hey, we're going to be in this place at this period of time. I can call you. I can call Rob. I can call Didi and say, okay, hey, I need a phone call to say, what do we change?
Right.
How do we change it?
And it's such a funny thing to me. I feel like that's one big thing I took for granted, maybe being in the army, was how loadout specific, like we would make things. You reference, you know, MyMedic, who I think they've got awesome stuff. They partner with TacMed Solutions, who is another big company, or like another medical company that we grab a lot of our stuff through. That's, you know, who our provider is mostly.
Yeah.
But I remember before I had the opportunity to kind of work with some of these companies, I would look and see like what kits were out there. And a lot of these kits had, you know, some of what I needed here and other things of what I needed there. And I it was so hard for me to find a kit that would be purposed enough to be effective.
Yeah.
We were doing a responsible citizen class for survival, which is just kind of free seminar for the public to, you know, give a little bit of information. But it was specifically on survival. And one of the students asked, what is the most gimmicky survival item that you think exists? And the other instructor, he told the student, I think the most gimmicky survival item are survival kits. You know, and I was like, oh dang, like that's absolutely right on the money. Mm-hmm. Because the kit, you know, like the buying a pre-made kit and just assuming that that's going to like cover all your bases is I think rarely going to be the case, unless it's hyper specific. But
well, we got, you know, as that MyMedic kit, we got given it. We took it with us. I didn't open it before.
Right.
I didn't go through it. I didn't know what was what and how to use it or whatnot. So it was something that I needed. And that's why we started the conversation. for where we needed to, you know, where we were going, the conditions we were going to be facing, and then taking care of the team that, you know, essentially I have responsibility over.
Right. And these are great opportunities for us, just, you know, from a standpoint, at least specifically for me, it always gives me this opportunity to kind of keep that mind muscle strong of being able to go, okay, you know, how am I going to build this or build that? And being able to kind of, it gives me an opportunity to fill that gap that I saw existed in some of the pre-made kits that were out there. It was, well, how do I make these specific things and fill that void a little bit? And so that's kind of, for all the stuff that Fieldcraft has coming down the pipe, this was a great rep almost for being able to, you know, how would we throw together this one specific kit for, you know, for these specific types of terrains or purpose or, mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a great opportunity for us. I wanted to ask you kind of maybe more your opinion about a conversation that I had with a friend that kind of ties into what you guys do. Sure. Or what I think you guys do.
Sure.
You know, we hear all the time, you know, hunting is conservation, right? And, yep. And for those of us that do hunt, it's our lineage or lifestyle, whatever the case yep. is for yep. where I'm from. But we, you know, often if we do get into a discussion with somebody that sees it differently, that doesn't think that hunting is ethical or whatever the question might be, or the issue might be, you know, the argument that's made amongst my circles a lot is like, hey, I hunt and because I hunt, I've done more for conservation than you have, mm-hmm. you know, especially just even in the fees that we mm-hmm. pay mm-hmm. is, you know, I've at least at a minimum, I've already donated more money towards, you know, wildlife conservation than, sure. than you have.
Sure.
What are some other like, misconceptions I think that mm-hmm. that people might have around mm-hmm. hunting in general and mm-hmm. why it actually is in fact conservation?
Yeah. So I think there's lots of ways that I could tackle this. So let's just start here in the US, right? So in the US, there's a thing called Pittman-Robertson. Pittman-Robertson is an act that got enacted in 1937 by Franklin D. Roosevelt. He signed it into law. It was spurred by Theodore, Teddy, in the 1900s, as Teddy was coming in, putting on the national parks into place, this big conservation ethos that started happening. Because at the time, the wildlife population had been completely decimated. Why? Because of market hunting. There was no legality around hunting. There was no regulations. There was no licenses. There was no nothing. It was a free-for-all. It was a supply and demand kind of situation. Mm. Sportsmen of the world, Teddy Roosevelt being one of them, said, look, we need to do something. We need to get our wildlife back. So in 1937, they did this thing called the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is an excise tax, a federal excise tax on ammunition, guns, and all hunting-related equipment. So without you knowing, anytime you buy something, there's already 11% tax that gets pulled from the manufacturer's perspective out of their pockets and sent to the U.S. Treasury. And it accumulates there every year. And then it gets sent to the Fish and Wildlife Service. Fish and Wildlife Service then distributes that money to every state DNR, Natural Resources Department, Wildlife Fisheries Department, Game and Fish Department, whatever your respective state has. That distribution of money is based on the land area of the state and how many licensed hunters you have. Very important point. I'll come back to it.
Yeah.
So a state like Maine or New Hampshire gets the de minimis. They don't meet the like threshold. They just get given a check, 9% check every year, 10% check every year. This year alone, from 2022, $1.6 billion got distributed to the states from PR. And that will go for habitat conservation. So acquisitions of land, public access for land, habitat restoration of those lands, wildlife work, wildlife education work, shooting ranges, shooting education, whatnot. So PR right now is made up of about 70% of the money comes from shooters, from recreational shooting. You go down to the shooting range, you buy ammunition, you like to shoot. 30% of it comes from hunters and hunting. Then you add on top of that your license fees, the tags that you have to buy every year. People don't quite understand that every animal you take has to have a tag. certain tags are a lot more expensive than other tags. So if I went to Wyoming to hunt an antelope every year, I may not hunt that antelope, but I have to pay into the system every year to buy preference points and whatnot. Wyoming, I may get the number wrong, but I think Wyoming every year from just license application fees makes like $44 million.
I did the math on that one time for Arizona. I was like, hey, if just even the residents, like how many Arizona residents are paying, you know, $40 for a license or even, hey, you know, $5, $15 for a draw application fee and what that revenue would be.
Yeah. Pennsylvania has a phenomenal bear season. They sell 225,000 tags a year. That's 200,000 tags, okay? It's a $10 tag or $25 tag, something like that.
Yeah.
They raise over $3.8 million for the coffers of Pennsylvania Wildlife and Fish, and only 1,000 bears are taken every year. So your percent chance of you actually taking a bear is like 2.8%, I think, is something along the numbers, right? It's a very low percentage. So again, if your cohort of individuals say, oh, you hunters, you're just killers. Well, in the Pennsylvania bear scenario, 2.8% of us are killers. So what's the rest of the 97%? They must be hunting for another reason, because 97% of them did not actually kill. White-tailed deer, the most abundant species in the US with the most prolific hunting population that there is to hunt. The percent of someone killing a white-tailed deer with their tags in the US is like 56%. In Canada, it's like 38%. For someone to kill a second deer, it's less than 5% in America. It's less than 1% in Canada. So again, the whole moniker, the rhetoric, oh, you hunters are just killers. The statistics show that that's untrue.
Right.
There must be something else. Well, then somebody would say, oh, you guys are just crappy hunters.
Right. Yeah.
You're terrible at hunting.
That's kind of how it feels sometimes.
Well, sometimes. But that's, again, there's reasons for why you enter into the woods. So there's the hunting is conservation line of like, go. If you somebody says, oh, hunting does nothing. Well, here, PR is the bastion of wildlife conservation. Then you take any wildlife population in the U.S., turkey, elk, antelope, all the duck species. White-tailed deer. White-tailed deer were 300,000 at the turn of the century. They're 32 million today.
Right.
Why? All you have to ask is ask the question, why? Why do we have more ducks today? Why do we have more turkeys today? Why does Kentucky have a new elk population today? Because someone values that wildlife to invest money into it, to grow the population, to be able to then sustainably utilize that resource. So that idea of sustainable use, the idea of value add, the idea that can be boiled into a phrase that if it pays, it stays, then projects across the rest of the world. So in South Africa is a private land model. Private land, you own the game. So if you have land in South Africa, you own the animals. So you can do whatever you want with the animals. You can breed them up. You can strip them off. You can get people to take photographs of them, or you can hunt them. You can do whatever you want. They're your animals. That model in the 1970s came into effect. At that time, they predicted there was about 500,000 head of wildlife in South Africa. The majority of them on national parks. So at the time, nobody owned wildlife. So the most valuable commodity for you to own was livestock and agriculture on your piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of a sudden, you've got a kudu that runs around your property, and you've got an American that says, I'll pay you $5,000 to shoot that kudu.
Right.
You're like, oh, that's the same amount of money that 100 cows would bring me, or 100 calves. Maybe wildlife is actually more valuable to me than livestock. And there was this flip. So today, there's between 22 and 26 million head of wildlife in South Africa alone, because of the value that they bring to the land, to the person who owns them, to the economy, to the communities, to you name it.
Right.
And so that's then the model, is like, if it pays, it stays. So when someone says, well, you know, I don't understand why rich Americans go to Africa to hunt, they just want to kill something. Be honest. Yeah, of course they do. That's why they're going. That's why they're going. So then take your fixation away from that rich American that is hunting that animal. And let me just divert it for a second to the benefits and consequences of that guy coming. and the money that he's about to spend.
Right.
Did you know that that hunting outfit in Tanzania has built a school that kids now get to go to school, that there's a medical clinic, that they have access to medical now, that, you know, 25 people are now employed, that then multiply that by 10 back to the community, that 250 people benefit from, that all the meat is sent back to the communities, that they're getting protein for the first time.
Right. No one would argue, you know, over any other tourism model. I mean, we're obviously...
But I'm not, you know, I'm not downing ecotourism. Ecotourism works where it works. But for the vast majority of Africa and other parts of the world, vast wilderness tracts in New Zealand, highlands of the high mountains of Pakistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, no tourists are going to these places just to go see it.
Right.
Some hunters are like, why am I even here? You know, but they're there because they want to chase an animal. They want to, again, let's be honest, they want to check a box that they killed that animal. Okay. Get over the idea, get over the motivation of the action of that individual. So let me give you the benefits and consequences, which is what Blood Origins is now doing. Like, that's what we're interested in. We're interested in showcasing the benefits and consequences. Pakistan, probably one of the best conservation success stories is the Markhor. You know what a Markhor is?
No.
It's this beautiful goat-like species. It's got huge spiral horns. Back in the 80s, I believe there was like, or 90s, there was probably about 300 of these Markhor left in Pakistan because they're a goat. They compete for the same resource as the local goats. And these guys are like, well, they're good meat, so we're just going to poach them. And there's no value to them, so we're just going to poach them, give our goats more grazing. Perfect. Well, all of a sudden, one of these Americans that wanted to check the box was like, oh, can I hunt one of those? They're like, oh, I don't know why we couldn't, you know. Right. How much are you willing to pay? Oh, $200,000. They're like, sold. Yeah. Sold.
Right, how many?
Today, there are over 3,500 Markhor on the landscape. 8 to 9 tags are sold every year of old mature animals that are sold between $120,000 and $240,000 each.
That's pretty wild.
75% of the money
for a goat.
Yeah. For a goat.
Yeah.
75% of the money goes back to the community.
Right.
All of a sudden, these communities in these high freaking mountain passes have electricity. They have solar. They have water. They have education. And they have the meat still.
Right.
The meat's
right.
Still there.
Yeah.
Here's the best. If, again, when you get back into this conversation and you use this example, you say, but that's not the best part of it. The best part of it is what is probably the coolest cat carnivore in the world. And I purposely used cool, so to help you.
Yeah, to say a line.
No, the coolest. I'm using it as a pun.
The coolest?
Yeah, a snow leopard.
Okay, all right.
You follow me?
Well, now I am.
Okay, good.
Well, you said cool, and I'm like, the coolest thing I can think of would be a lion.
All right, I get it.
That's pretty wild.
So a snow leopard, highly endangered. Mm-hmm. How do you think snow leopards are doing today? Phenomenally. Their population is exploding. Why? Because they have a prey base that they can chase because of hunting.
Hey guys, it's Amber L here, and I wanted to tell you about one of our partners. It's Athletic Greens. But more specifically, I wanted to tell you about AG1 by Athletic Greens. And if you're familiar with my lifestyle at all, or follow me in any capacity, you know that I have really taken ownership of my health and wellness over the last year. And I hold myself to new standards, and I've implemented some really strict disciplines that have extremely increased my overall wellness and vitality. And that's so important to me as a mom, but also for someone who takes their own self-defense and their own empowerment really seriously. And so one place where I feel like we all fall short is trying to keep up with our supplement routine. And AG1 is a life hack of sorts. And I love life hacks. And it's an all-in-one formula that makes it easy for me to cover my nutritional bases every day. One scoop is packed with 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients. And not just of basic average quality, but of really great quality. That's very important to me because of the bioavailability and the way that my body utilizes it. And so you get those benefits like gut and mood support and boosted energy and healthy looking skin, hair, and nails. And we all want that. So if you're looking for an easier way to take your supplements and you want to give them a try, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. So you can go to athleticgreens.com/fieldcraft to check them out. That's athleticgreens.com/fieldcraft. And then I also want to tell you about a women's warrior hunt retreat, and it's combined with a 3D archery shoot over in California, right outside of San Diego. This will be May 31st to June 4th. This will be my second time attending this retreat, and I will be there with other team members where we will be outlining how your survival and your preparedness and self-reliance make you so much more capable and ready to get out there this hunting season. It's going to be amazing, and I can't wait to meet all of you guys. So if any of those things sound good to you and you feel called to really push yourself this year, I highly suggest you come out and meet us. This is what we love to do, is to train with you guys. So check out our website so you can read more about it. And I hope you guys enjoy the rest of the podcast.
And so I guess my, if you pay, it stays.
Correct.
So then again, your specific organization, it's like, unless someone is paying attention, and is anyone capturing the fact that that's the model that's being replicated place over place? Or
correct.
You mean, because the cattle in South Africa, when they recognize, oh, well, they're the ones making these decisions of like, hey, the wildlife are probably going to be more valuable to us. So this is where we should be investing resources. Mm-hmm. In other countries, I mean, like, do they have any other driving forces other than just free market economy or...
The only other driving force that is protecting wildlife, which is, I think, where you're getting to around the world, would be the philanthropic model, which is your big, I don't even know what there's a colloquialism for them, like a cinnamon, but they're your big NGOs. They're your WWFs, your WCS is your Wildlife Conservation Society, World Wildlife Fund. You name it, there's thousands of them, right? Your elephant conservation, you've got VetPaw, which is a veteran-owned animal conservation organization. There are literally thousands of them. And what they do is, some of them do very, very, very good work, you know? WCS is pulling up land and protecting habitat, which is the key, right? We all can agree, whether you're an anti-hunter or you're a hunter, the most fundamental component to maintaining wildlife on this planet is habitat, because there's a booming human population that's fragmenting habitat, that's pushing and squeezing wildlife into smaller, smaller areas and not allowing them to migrate and move between, you know, population pockets.
Right.
So if you can protect habitat, I don't care how you do it, whether it's using hunting as a model for game management or a philanthropic model, which is you raise a lot of money with big donors and you keep it protected.
How often do you feel like that's part of the conversation between, you could say, you know, pro or anti-hunting organizations, is like, hey, well, the one thing that we can at least agree upon is habitat. Mm. And that at least maybe start as a common ground.
There's unfortunately no way to have common ground. And here's why. I'll give you an example. There was an elephant tender out of Namibia. And what that was the government was selling 112 live elephants. So the Namibian government has put up for tender 112 elephants for sale. And we looked into it. We're like, man, this would be the best thing ever. Let's raise the money. Let's move these elephants and let's put them in a national park. But let's do it like Blood Origins with the Humane Society. Let's come together. These elephants will never get hunted.
Right.
They'll get put into a national park. They'll never get hunted. But they would never do it. It was a $4 million project. It would have landed on CNN. But what would have landed on CNN is the Humane Society partnered with a hunting organization. What's the first thing that would have happened? They would have lost an enormous donor base.
Right.
Just because they did a partnership with a hunting organization. So it all comes down to money.
Oh,
yeah, all comes down to them raising funds.
Again, I mean, because these are things that, again, like, are not normally talked about, that aren't normally part of a narrative. A lot of it, what's interesting is it kind of comes down to almost the ethical, you know, argument. And it's only focused on the specific act of, you know, like maybe killing the animal, not all of the second and third order effects of, yeah, but look at the overall population of the animal. Like, look at all the benefits of economy being driven to some of these areas that might otherwise have zero economy.
Yeah. I think it does often come down to an ethical question, but I think a question that a lot of people like shy away from, because it's a very easy one to sort of solve. It's like, who has the sovereign right to decide how to use their resources? Karen out of Los Angeles or Peter Ndebele that's living on the land in Zimbabwe? I think Peter Ndebele he's the guy who says, I'm going to use the wildlife like this.
Right.
Because it's our resource. It's just like oil. Nobody's telling the Saudis or anybody else how to use your oil or, you know, what to do with your oil.
Right. And this just came up as I'm thinking about it. How do you think game and fish organizations, state to state, are managing resources?
I think they're doing as good a job as they possibly can with the limited amount of resources that they get. It's a state government issue writ large, right? You could say the same thing. How well are state veteran organizations doing? Or how good, exactly.
Right.
How good are state medical organizations? It's the same. They're all on a shoestring budget. And if they had more money, they could do phenomenal things.
Do you see money being pulled out of hunting and wildlife conservation budgets for money essentially switching pots? How much, I mean, because when you start talking about how much money should be going into wildlife, and obviously, you know, it goes faster than you think that it might. But when you look at the money that states can raise from big game draws, from, you know, hunting licenses in general, how much, you know, a tax on hunting equipment already is going to generate revenue, where, you know, do you see money that should be going towards hunting and wildlife conservation to being put towards other, taken out of that pot, put down
the things? No, I don't see that. And I think you got to remember that the game and fish department of every state has a mandate much greater than game species. They have a habitat mandate. They have a non-game species mandate.
Right.
You know, so gopher tortoises, indigo snakes, red cockaded woodpeckers. Those are all things that a state game and fish department are in charge of.
Right.
Not just the white-tailed deer. Yeah. The white-tailed deer brings the money, but the white-tailed deer, that money helps protect those three species that live under its umbrella.
Right.
So I don't think you're seeing state agencies push and pull money around. What you are going to start seeing, and that's why I made an emphasis earlier about hunter license sales tying into PR. Mm-hmm. A lot of the non-game species work is funded through PR. Well, what happens when hunting starts getting banned in respective states? Spring bear season just got taken away in Washington state. Mm-hmm. So even though there's not a lot of tags, it's not a lot of licenses, it's 150 or 215, something like that. That's 215 people who may decide, I'm not buying a hunting license this year.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely think people, you know, it's rare that I think that I have, out of all my friends that hunt, most of them buy hunting licenses in Arizona because they want to put in for big game elk. And, you know, like the last few elk camps that I've been sitting in, I'm one of the few people that are less than 40. You know, most of the people that are, you know, are hunting, you know, a lot of my dad's friends are, you know, older generation. So maybe that's another anecdotal example, but do you see kind of like everything else, right? You know, like the baby boomers are getting ready to get, you know, to go away.
Yeah.
And the up and coming generation is not feeling the same the same gaps, you know, and voids are being created.
Yeah, I think people are worried that you've got this bell curve that everything, these baby boomers are going to fall out. Essentially, they're not going to be
kick the bucket,
or they're just not their buddies. They're not going hunting anymore, so they're not buying licenses anymore. Until you're going to see that tail off go, but I think we're going to see almost like a sort of cyclical thing. I think the 20 to 35 year old age class is going to start moving up. I think a lot more people are getting more and more interested in hunting. There's a big locavore movement everywhere. I think we're going to see a dip. And, you know, that's why R3 is a big thing right now. R3 is retain, reactivate, recruit new hunters, because they're worried about this like slippage to maintain our status quo, maintain the money that's being pushed into PR, maintain our voice. But I think it's going to dip and then it's going to come back up. Like I was just here I was here the last time in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. I was here for the Western Hunt Expo. And it was very, very encouraging. There were the median age group of people walking around that thing, that show was like 35 to 45. There were no gray haired guys running around there.
Is that what people are seeing is that what Game and Fish is seeing in applications?
Mm-hmm.
Is the same demographics some may be dipping, but hopefully like others rising. We were again having a conversation about elk was if as few people were getting into elk hunting as what the perception is, and perception is again anecdotal. It's not numbers of Game and Fish reporting, but then like, will there be a time in the future that elk tags in Arizona could be over the counter again?
I highly doubt that.
Well, I mean, that's an extreme example, but you kind of, you know, that, there are some species that are still over the counter, and you know what that looks like what that dip looks like in terms of species management.
Yeah, I don't know. That's like looking into a crystal ball,
right?
In terms of I definitely don't think we're going back to an over the counter. And there's so many things that play in. There's so many confounding variables like climate and nutrition and predators and right. You know, when there's a dip in hunter licenses as the baby boomers go out, they're not applying anymore. Less tags being given out means more population on the ground, which means in 4 or 5 years there's now an overabundant population of elk. You need to reduce it because of habitat constraints, because of human pressure. There's less habitat. Okay, now over the counter, because we need to cut the elk herd back,
right?
So, but we're not going to ever get back to where, say, we were in the 60s and 70s, where over-the-counter elk was a thing in Arizona, but there was also maybe 2 million people in Arizona at the time, versus now
there's 35
million or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And I guess another good thing that I, again, would be anecdotal is, I think there's a lot of people, you know, maybe more my age who are interested in getting into hunting, but hunting can be an intimidating thing to get into when you have no idea. Now, some people still try to bridge that gap. They put in, or they go elk hunting or whatever, like, you know, by themselves, or I mean, really hunting anything. And I'm curious what the success rates are starting to look like. If more inexperienced hunters are getting out there, even just trying their hand at it.
Well, again, it's all dependent, right? And so here's the thing. Here's the crux of the matter. And this is a huge debate in the hunting space. This idea of fair chase, right? And hunting is chasing, pursuing, and hopefully taking an animal. Hopefully meaning that there's a component of failure built into this definition of hunting, okay?
Right.
But if you are hunting, the intent of you hunting is to kill something. If it's not, then you're just hiking.
Right.
With a weapon. So would you not want to do everything that you possibly can to make yourself as successful as possible?
Mm-hmm.
I would argue the answer is yes. But to what extreme do you take that garnering of success to? That's the debate. So someone would say, there's people out there that would say, oh, long range hunting, shooting an animal at 500 yards, 600 yards, that is not fair chase. It's unethical. Shouldn't be in hunting.
Right.
Like, okay. So, but isn't the, again, it's this walk through a scenario. Isn't the purpose of you hunting to successfully kill an animal? The answer is yes. Okay. If at 500 yards, I can get myself very comfortable, I can get myself in a position where I can execute an absolutely lethal shot on that animal. I'm calm, I'm collected, that animal's going to die. Versus me trying to get as close as I possibly can to that animal to cross some sort of invisible barrier, which is now I'm in a range that is ethical to kill that animal. Nobody can tell us what that number is. Boone and Crockett will say that you need to be in a circle of awareness around an animal. I've heard people like the Gunworks people say, why would you want that? Why would you want an animal like really jittery in terms of knowing that you're, something is not right? That's going to maybe get them to jump a shot or to do something that would be unnormal in the scenario of you being, the animal has no idea of your existence. So what I'm trying to get at here is that there's this whole debate around success and long range shooting and scopes and all that kind of stuff will make you more effective of a hunter, i.e. more successful of a hunter. However, being more successful does mean that more tags are being filled. But that's just a wildlife management issue then.
Right. Yeah, then so, just the number of tags that are essentially going to be correct. Issued.
But then that, so then we bring in one more circle, which is then if there's less tags to be had, you just decided to become a hunter. You can't get access to hunt because there's less tags available. Right. So does that help hunting or hurt hunting?
I mean, I guess depending on if people continue to pay to stay, you know.
Well, it depends. Yeah, exactly. So do you have to hunt an elk in a unit that is going to take you 10 years to pull? Or if you truly are wanting to hunt, there's over-the-counter elk opportunities, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, but you're going to have to work your butt off.
Right.
To get successful. Which is, again, part of hunting, which is the point of hunting.
The big debate that we just had in Arizona, I think not too long ago, was...
trail cameras.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were right in the middle of that. Yeah. We actually podcasted with the commissioners. Uh-huh. Then we podcasted with the guys that were going to sue the commissioners.
Right.
Then we podcasted with the commissioners again. Yeah, we were the spear tip.
So then, can I ask you what your opinion on it was then?
Yeah, I think that there is... I think the commissioners... had to make a decision whether it was for fair chase, which was the argument that they made, or it was for conflict resolution. They had to, I'm not a commissioner, they decided writ large across the state, trail cameras are out for the take of wildlife. Now, there's a lot of grayness around that. Can you go put a camera on a watershed on a hole so that your kids and you can look at the animals coming in and, oh, you happen to hunt that same watershed 8 months later, but the camera hasn't been in there for 7 months and an animal you killed was on that camera 8 months ago. Is that now the take of wildlife? They got to figure that all out.
Right. Well, because I mean, that was what I understood was the rule was like, it just, the cameras can't be up during the season.
That is correct. But there's also, so if I was them, I would have said there's units that were the conflict units, make it a season, put it on those units and then evaluate.
Right.
But the fact that it went through the commission, it didn't go through the legislature, those kinds of things can be amended. They can be adapted through time.
Right. Well, I mean, that to me was also the.
But I believe the Arizona trail camera ban is a full year. It's like you cannot put it out, period, for the take of wildlife.
Gotcha. The last part of what you said was, hey, try it out and then evaluate, which is the other thing that most people generally have apprehension for a lot of stuff. Because, you know, they'll say like, oh, well, once something's gone, what's the odds of it coming back? You know,
from a legislative perspective, absolutely.
Right.
That's tough. That's a cut that you can't get back. But through a regulatory mechanism like the commission, those are things that can be remedied.
Well, I mean, because I mean, arguably, those should be kind of tools in their arsenal to be able to manage the wildlife.
Yeah. And so I, when you heard me talk about long range shooting, you heard me say effective, not efficient. Trail cameras were argued that they're making more efficient as a hunter, i.e. I don't have to spend as much time out there because I know where the animals are.
Right.
Which almost sounds like cheating. Almost says, takes the sort of one of the fair chase components out of it.
Right. Because I can, yeah, I mean, cause I mean, I know people that's like that 100%, they have cameras up and they drive up maybe once a month to pull an SD card. They can figure out like what the movement has been,
yep,
the traffic at specific spots.
Yep.
And then,
they hunted accordingly to the information.
Yeah. And,
and more than likely, they may not actually take the animal that they're after. So there's a lot of evidence out there that the cameras actually didn't do what they're supposed to do. And that's why Pope and Young and the National Deer Association have still have trail cameras classified as fair chase.
Mm-hmm.
They say it's a good tool to understand your population. It's also a good tool for management. Because if you know that there's a much bigger elk in the area or a much bigger X animal in the area, then you wouldn't take the more immature animal.
Right.
Because you know that there's a possibility of getting something better.
Right.
Which helps with the management, overall management of the herd.
Otherwise, what's the rule? It's like, don't pass on anything on day one that you would take on day 14.
Yeah.
Whatever the last day is.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So basically, I think because I've got a lot of friends that come and ask me as a resource, like, all right, hey, you know, how do I get into this? Mm-hmm. And so I think I think the argument they might be making is, hey, listen, we need whether you get to hunt or not, or again, it's even like in the opportunities are out there, diversify.
Correct.
You know, figure out where the opportunities are. And if you're interested in hunting for whatever those reasons for you might be.
Plenty stuff to hunt.
Yeah. You know, then diversify in what those opportunities are, go find them. But ultimately it's, you know, you'll do a lot for wildlife management in your state by having a hunting license.
100%.
So then that being the first step, all right, go get your hunting license. And then what are some of the best resources that people can start going through? How do we start getting more self-motivated, self-starting hunters out there?
I think it's just use the thing that everyone uses is Google. Just Google hunt mentoring in your state.
Hmm.
You're going to find so many different programs. You're going to find so many different people. Most organizations have a hunter recruitment project. They have a hunter recruitment program. You can find something if you just do a little bit of digging. And even species dependent.
That's what actually one thing that I think is really cool about for all the interactions that I've had with Game and Fish is I've reached out to Game and Fish lots of times and said, hey, I've got drawn for this zone or for this area. Can you point me in a direction? Can you know, like time of year, I can go out there these times. And I have yet to have a single interaction that was not positive of them trying to be helpful and supportive and, you know, I mean, So I think it's a good thing out there that what, you know, they're trying to do. And the hard part is, I don't know, optics maybe.
Yeah, it's optics, but also let's not get it wrong. Getting into hunting it's a high barrier of entry. There's a couple of big hurdles to get over. Access being one of them, knowledge being another.
Yeah.
But you can get over the knowledge hurdle by just Googling and finding people. And then these mentoring situations often give you access to a place to hunt for the first time. And then that just develops relationships and it's all about who you know in this world.
Yeah.
And it just goes everything from there.
Right. Yep. I know that's a tough mentoring program to run though. I mean, to almost advertise yourself as like, hey, do you want to come hang
people
out?
People do it.
You want to come hang out in the woods together?
Yeah, no, there's lots of those. There's, but then there's also a paid sort of pay to play scenario also.
Right.
So if you're not like, you can pay, you know, Outdoor Solutions has a field to table course that you can do most of it happens in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That you go, you learn how to shoot, you learn how, you go take an animal, you kill, you hunt, and then they teach you how to process the animal. They teach you how to, all the cuts, how to cook it, everything. Soup's nuts. So there's lots of places like that too.
Right. I mean, and again, we have common friends of, again, who run the types of retreats and seminars and things and of being able to, you know, to go through all those components. Again, the Mike and Chris Cook at the ranch, they're Jillian, yep, and the exactly. seminars that they run. I mean, I'm always blown away by how many people show up with little to no experience, and because they want to get into it. Those opportunities are out there. Like these organizations exist because they see the value as such a good thing, and they create this whole thing around mm-hmm. trying to build that community.
100%.
Anyway, is there anything about Blood Origins? Where should people start when coming to learn about you? What is the best way that we can support efforts? I've seen a bunch of, you know, like I'm always impressed by, like, I've been, you know, watching a lot of your stuff on Instagram and how, like, literally all over the place.
Yep.
Hunting, the conversations you're having about hunting are.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's fun because it's information from other places in the world. And it's fun because it's stuff like, you know, in either my own backyard, like the Arizona trail cameras, or even, yep. you know, things that I've been super interested in, like wolves in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the conversations you've had about, like, what, you know, down to the nitty gritty of, like, plans that are being proposed and verbiage that exists for some sections and maybe not for others.
Sure.
And so, you know, again, like, what are some of these big education pieces that are relevant to people getting into it?
Well, just I would say the easiest way to sort of figure it out is follow us, Google us. You'll find everything that we do online. You know, we just create content, documentaries, infographics, videos, documentaries. If you like what we do, engage us, share the content, share the message, because I think that's where people in hunting specifically, they don't like to share non-kill related content. I don't know why, but it is what it is.
Right.
So share our content. It's not sharing the message. It's not trying to promote Blood Origins. It's just promoting the message and the education and the information that comes with it. And if you feel like we're doing a good job, we have a supporters program, the cost of a cup of coffee a month. You can donate to, as I said, we're a 501c3 public charity. So tax deduction, write-off against your business. And, you know, you support what we do every single day. And you get thrown into a bunch of different giveaways. We have a bunch of sweepstakes every month. And if you have a company, if you want to support us as a company, we have a corporate conservation club. Again, completely tax deductible against the business. Support us doing what we do every single day.
Awesome. I appreciate you coming and trusting us enough, or maybe me specifically, for doing some of the med stuff.
For sure.
I'm excited about it. I'm excited to build more stuff. If you guys get to go more places, and I've already learned a ton from following you guys and getting to know you. And hopefully we can increase the number of information out there. It's like, I think that's definitely a worthy fieldcraft endeavor, is along the lines of, you know, self-sufficiency, preparedness. And I mean, I guess you could even boil it down, even if it was just recreation, the bottom line is we want to be the education arm, mm-hmm. you know, to actually arm people with the information to go out and be mm-hmm. ethical, successful mm-hmm. hunters.
No, I appreciate it.
Cool.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks for hanging out.